Welcome back to the Think Education podcast. Professor Judith Lammy and myself joining you with a conversation that will start with a roundup about things that we know, and then we'll go into things that we don't know, I suppose. Judith recently attended, which I'm very jealous about because I was watching, literally stalking it on LinkedIn from afar, attended the UKI event last week, right? I mean, it's very recent.
That's right.
Yes. You had to travel by train, I suppose?
I did, and the trains were working. So, yes, it was the first in-person International Higher Education Forum from Universities UK International and Friends since COVID.
Yeah.
So it was wonderful to see. And must have been, I don't know exactly how many, we did get the delegate list, but there must have been a good few hundred people there. And it was at Senate House, University of London.
Yep.
Great place. Always discussions around anything Orwellian when it comes to being in Senate House. But it's a great location, and it's also a really convenient location, of course, for whether you're coming from anywhere in the UK, to be honest, but also anywhere globally. There are a lot of people from all over. So it was great to be able to see people and have the kind of conversations that we continue to have, quite rightly and usefully online. But to be able to have those and some people did beam in, but some of the speakers, but most obviously all the delegates and that were there in person. So it was great. It was really good to have that and to be able to talk about the current situation when it comes to international higher education.
And everything's perfect, right? There's no challenges with the current education anywhere. Everything's going, ticking along.
Every single country, not a problem at all.
Oh,
internationalisation and international students celebrated by local, regional and national governments and universities head up as that, put up there as that wonderful beacon to guide us through our future and to help us gain, success in that future or not.
Yeah, you almost have to wonder why did UKI bother? Frankly, it's if everything's going perfectly, why bother?
Why bother bringing lots of people from across the world into the same place so we can share the grief across all of the team? I suppose one thing, and I think sometimes these conferences, I think I mentioned the last time when I chaired the TNE conference for them in December, that what I found particularly refreshing. And that has continued and does continue, is I think the openness and transparency and honesty that you get more in conferences now, I think, than we used to. You would very often, if there were people giving presentations and they were located either in a certain business or at a certain university, they'd get up for 20 minutes, they'd tell you how fantastic the world was and their university was brilliant.
Yeah.
And this is what we're really, really good at. And here's all the awards we've won. Oh, and by the way, this is what I'm talking about, and the end.
Yes.
And it's not that that wasn't sometimes marginally interesting, but you didn't learn anything, really.
Yeah.
And I think what is much more open now is just the fact that people are discussing what they are doing and where the direction of travel is and where the need is for us to be focusing. And, the great thing for this event as well that was that we had students on the panel, so instead of us trying to presume what people were thinking and students were thinking, we got them there, selection of their saying, this is what we think. You've got that, and you've got that sort of that opportunity to have an open discussion and about the challenges, about what we're doing about it, and about with something to what we don't know we're going to do.
Yeah,
to
sure.
Be honest. And, but as a consequence, you can. It's usually about, it's a little bit like one of those curves that you get, or even a marriage curve in a sense, But so you meet and it's all wonderful and you're all in love and you're like, oh, goodness me, I've not seen you for ages, and everybody's hugging. And then people think, oh, COVID, stand over there, quickly sanitize yourself. you know. And so you're really happy because you're meeting and you're having that initial discussion, and then you start to get into the real sort of nitty-gritty of the situation, and you sort of spiral a bit into a bit of a depression because you realise that in most places there are severe challenges when it comes to international higher education, whether you're a student, whether you're a member of staff, whether you're an institution, whether you're a local or national government, you know, some of whom, of course, are causing these challenges themselves to themselves. So it can then, you can get a little bit like, right, somebody's got to say something positive in a minute, because otherwise none of this is going to end well. So what can we do? What are we doing? And can we see a light at the end of the tunnel? And of course, we're all in education, so we end up reaching that conclusion by the end. But it, you know, what came really clear to me was that it is a massively challenging time for most people across the globe, quite honestly. You know, we had some very interesting presentations and discussions from people from different countries, different areas. You know, obviously, you know, England, the UK, we've had these discussions before around the challenges we've got there. We've got the report from the, you know, the Migration Advisory Council coming up on the 14th of May. As you will know, they were given the unreasonably short deadline to achieve a review, which they did undertake, as I've said before, absolutely superbly. You know, Professor Brian Bell and his team are outstanding. But nobody knows what's going to happen with that.
Yeah.
And therefore, because nobody knows what's going to happen with that, or indeed what the outcomes might be from anything further with regard to, obviously we've had what's happened with regard to dependence, but anything to do with the graduate route, you know, we don't really know what's going to happen. So that level of uncertainty still exists. And that's had a dramatic effect on recruitment coming into UK higher education institutions, you know, to the effect of 50%+ of international students for some institutions. I mean, you're talking across a sector, hundreds of millions of pounds, you know. And it isn't just about the institutions, of course, that are affected. Of course they are, and their staff and their students. But it is the local regions. I mean, I was giving a talk about this the other day, and indeed was talking to the advisory committee about it and the impact that international students have on Wales and what they bring in and what they feed into the economy, you know. And again, you know, you're talking, you know, in excess of £100 million across a very small country, each of the constituent parts, you know, receiving at least around 10 million additional income into that region because of them. So if you purely were looking at this selfishly and financially, it isn't a good thing to be damaging, let alone then what might happen if universities start to fold, because many of them, of course, they're, again, it's not only the numbers of staff you employ, but it's the impact on the region, you know, the enterprises, small, medium enterprises that have got what they've got because they're connected into the university. It's a whole ecosystem, you know. So there's that side of it. But then we hear about the challenges that they've got in Canada, having done a very similar thing last year. And they're talking to the Canadian equivalent of the head of Universities UK, was also giving a presentation. This is just one example, you know, but he was saying that it's going to take probably their education system about 2 years to get over it. And, you know, it's and it was largely driven because they did want to encourage people to come to Canada. They did. They were successful in that. They were successful in that, and they therefore wanted to stay. They wanted to work, which is why they were encouraged to go, and they were given incentives to go. And then they took up housing and things like that, and then people complained because there wasn't enough housing in certain areas. And so instead of trying to think of different, potentially more sophisticated ways of dealing with that kind of issue, which I'm not saying wasn't an issue, and I'm sure it is. I don't know. I've been to Canada, but I'm not Canadian, and I don't know the detail. But I'm sure that simply trying to stop that particular route of entry for people coming in, or indeed for making it difficult for people to remain, probably wasn't the best thing in the world to do. And then, you know, there are other places. So there was that. That was quite a key theme, and just what we need to do, how we need to work closely with governments and others to try and articulate maybe more clearly the value of higher education, not only to individuals, but, as I say, just selfishly for people, to regions and to countries themselves. So that was one big chunk of a theme, which was one that left us all feeling a little bit depressed, because there weren't too many, you know, beacons of light there. But other things that came out were, I mean, maybe two others to mention, and then we can touch upon some of these, trying to finish on a high note, lest we totally depress the audience as well. The increase of online study, you know, and the fact that that has been something that has been increasing, certainly across, we found across Europe, across other places, you know, students engaging in online education. But not, an interesting point came out was that not so much for the entire program or the entire degree, but where the increase more dramatically has come in students deciding to study for, let's say, the first 1 or 2 years online and then travelling to wherever they might have wanted to initially travel to finish the program. So, you know, you might be living in Zambia and you might decide that you want to study for the first 1 or 2 years online, and then if you're an undergraduate, go and finish your degree elsewhere, or you might want to do your master's elsewhere. And, you know, I think there are a mixture of reasons there. Obviously, when this is happening a little bit more in certain parts of Europe, and that, I think, has been directly as a result of Brexit and the challenges with regard to finances for a lot of students. And for many, it might not be that the actual online programme itself is much less when it comes to cost, but, of course, you don't have the cost of everything else.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Because you're still at home, you know. Sponging off your family, so you don't have to pay for accommodation. There's a lot that you lose. Of course, you do that whole, environment, education environment. But it's all. I think students, I think, can be quite pragmatic about it. They can think, well, I don't want to do this full time. Maybe all the, for the whole of my degree. But if I do it for half of it, or even just the first year, what I'm saving there, and you can make a conscious effort to save what you might have spent on accommodation, for example. And then, and then come. So that was the second one. And then finally, the third point that came out, very much articulated by the students that were present, was the increasing importance for universities and colleges and institutions to be focusing on supporting students in terms of employability, graduate outcomes. Now, that is writ large and high in the UK when it comes to our home students. But, I think it's safe to say that places have less of a focus when it comes to how we support and track our international students and how far we do that, once they've graduated. What do we do for them to help them secure employment or give them those opportunities to look for when they're at the university, and how much longer do we support them when they're alumni? Some universities support them 5 years or more. Some, as soon as they've graduated, they're like, bye. And that's it. So those were, I think, three of the sort of chunks of things, national situation, the online study, and employability and graduate outcomes.
I mean, it's fascinating, because there's elements of those that I think mark a very real shift in the realities of higher education, whether we've accepted them or not. They are fundamentally changing, and in a sense that the disruption that's happened is being responded to by students who are now looking at the system and saying, well, okay, I'm not just going to jump into this blindly, or I'm not just going to follow this track. It's very interesting, that thing about students the first 1 or 2 years perhaps being online particularly when the traditional view, you know, the first 1 to 2 years are, that's the socialization, that's where you, you know, you're in halls or you meet your friends and, you know, you sort of form those types of things. And particularly maybe the first year is a little easier, so it's maybe more fun and, you know, it sort of evolves that way. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see then how institutions respond to these changes in patterns, because, you know, if you keep trying to stick to the same model and say that's based on tradition or based on credibility or based on whatever it might be, but the consumer or the participants or the stakeholders are not engaging with it in the same way, then we need to think about that. I mean, and in a sense, it also opens massive opportunities in terms of online digital collaboration. Like, you've got distance opportunities with partnership where, you know, I mean, I think Cornell did this during the pandemic, where they had the sort of study at home abroad, and they sort of partnered with these, you know, facilities around the world, and you could, you know, you could engage to a point, but at a very, very low cost to you, the young student who potentially could still work at the same time. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out. I mean, I find it amazing that, you know, some of those figures, you know, and those impacts you're talking about in the first point about, you know, it could be, you know, 2+ years before, and you think, how is it that we've done to ourselves something that's going to be harder to recover from than COVID?
Yes.
Because the COVID numbers rebounded so fast, almost, that, you know, it was like, oh, well, I guess we didn't have to worry about, you know, student numbers and mobility went up. And now, I mean, it's as you say, obviously, it's not without contextual realities that there are very real problems and pressures and challenges and costs. And, you know, it's not as simple saying, well, you people on this side are completely wrong because you're trying to, it's like, no, it's not that simple of an issue. But at the same time, yes, there potentially are other ways we can think about the problem beyond the sort of the vilifying and, like, let's just turn off the tap and then, yeah. Oh, look, when did that happen?
Look at what's happened when we've removed these several universities from their cities, and we don't seem to have a lot of the small businesses around anymore, and we don't have these shops here anymore, and we don't have these people don't have jobs anymore. I wonder why that's happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. And I mean, in the defence of the governments in various places, it's not right to, it's not to have a pop at any one individual one in particular. It's more of a general point, really. But actually, of course, there are individuals within governments. There are individuals within the UK government, for example, and areas there that absolutely do understand and are doing everything that they can to try and provide, I suppose, as well, some more compelling evidence. I mean, and it just makes common sense that this is an issue, and that there would be a dramatic effect, and it wouldn't be good. But unfortunately, you can't rely on common sense. So sometimes you have to try and look at the data, don't you? And I think one thing that people have been doing has been working on just trying to illustrate what that kind of impact is. But it's very, very simple for people just to use big numbers and figures when it comes to, for example, to migration and to international students. And of course, you can evidence how wonderfully you have affected your migration stats by showing that you've gone from this number to this number. And without evidencing really then what that kind of impact is. So I think there's people hope that common sense will prevail. We have learned over the, well, we've learned full stop, I suppose, just in life that common sense rarely prevails, quite frankly. Mm. It's just that occasionally the thing happens that you would hope would happen. So certainly in you know, the UK, we are hoping that some form of sense will indeed see us right out the other end. But you never quite know. The point though, like you were saying though, which was interesting, because I did read, and I think it might have even been when we were writing the last book actually, you know, there was quite a lot written about online, obviously during the pandemic. Mm. We all pivoted. A few of us have stopped using that word for a year. You can start using it again now, I think. Mm-hmm. We're not using it all the time. that and unprecedented, pivoted and unprecedented in the same sentence, go for it. But we all shifted online because we had to, because otherwise there wasn't going to be anything. And a lot of people have shifted back, you know, but it did probably just accelerate some of the trend that there already was, that meant that online study was, you know, becoming popular for some. But it was particularly interesting, I think, seeing some of the points from the plenary, that the fact that there's been that marketing increase in online, particularly for, you know, the first or second year. So seeing it as more like a feeder, you know, program into
An actual pathway.
Your own program. Yeah, it's a pathway program. We know how popular those are with certain areas in society as well.
Yeah.
Q are writing about that. But I thought that was interesting. And as you said, though, Chris, of course, as well, you have to go with market demand. And if it of course, we think that it's much better if you can, or we think it's much better if you can be there in person, learning in person, you get all of the, but we're starting to operate in a world that a lot of which is virtual,
mm-hmm.
people. So, you know, sometimes it might not matter. You might be going into a job or into a profession where you never have to get out of your pajamas. So maybe you don't necessarily need those kind of skills. You need different sorts of skills.
Yep.
You know, so I think sometimes we still retain that. Of course, I do believe there's so much that you can get, certainly so many in terms of those interpersonal and cultural skills,
yeah.
that are easier to acquire in person. But this seems to be giving people, you know, potentially the best of both worlds, really.
Yeah. I think it's also, it probably links to, in a way, to the third point you were outlining in terms of employability, because I guess it would have been, I don't know, early 2010, something like that, when I was in Malaysia. I was working with a few colleagues and we did a British Council project looking at the sort of relative value or employability of international degrees versus local degrees, and kind of how they were perceived by both students and then employers. You know, a student who had studied abroad fully was prized, you know, highest, and then a student who'd had sort of study, you know, a study exchange or, you know, partial abroad, and then, you know, a student at an international university, and then, you know, sort of down. But it was very much tied into the very traditional view that learning and experience was physical and in person. And therefore, by extension, online or remote or exchange was lesser than. But since COVID, obviously we've had to, whether we, you know, I think employers accept that more readily than maybe some governments or institutions, where it's like, well, no, actually the online space, the ability to operate in the online space, the ability to socialize in the online space actually has considerable value. And so, yes, there is merit in being physically there to socialize, etc. But actually, it's not now a detriment that you weren't. And if you've got that sort of hybrid thing, you know, you've got another set of skills that you can, you know, leverage that have currency. And that's, I think, that's a cultural change. Almost accidentally, that universities can I don't know what the word would be. Say that we do. It's probably the wrong way of doing it, but you know, it's kind of like accidentally we can add it to what it is that we provide our students, because this perspective of, you know, a traditional degree and a traditional job, that doesn't exist. I mean, that's done. I wrote an article again years ago with a colleague in Malaysia, and we were talking about the difference between employment and employability. And even, you know, sort of 10-15 years ago, universities were no longer guaranteeing employment, and nor frankly we thought should they. Like, that's not the point of a university. If the point is to guarantee employment, then there are other avenues for that which are more efficient and more successful and probably have more value and use to the community and society, you know. But at the same time, with the investment in time and cost and being away from family and etc., there has to be a value statement to a university degree. And yes, as you say, if that's employability, if that's skills somehow packaged and somehow articulated. I mean, I know it comes back to that constant debate about us and them, you know, universities and employers, and they can't dictate our curriculum, mm-hmm. and we know what's best, and then we graduate people and then they have to go and retrain them because actually we haven't taught them anything that they need for the actual job, and, you know, the piece of paper doesn't matter. You know, it's not like that debate's not going anywhere. I mean, that debate's coming to a crux, right? It's so was there a sense of, because you said there were students on the panel, was there student input and feedback about this sort of, I mean, I assume they're current students, yeah. right? I guess they were current students as opposed to graduates,
yes.
right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, there were students on various panels. You've got masters, you've got undergraduates, you've got people who had just graduated, obviously alumni from the ones on the particular panel that I'm referring to were current students, and they were talking about not only therefore then why they'd come to the institutions they'd come to and courses they'd come on, but also what their expectations were, you know, and many of them, or many of their friends anyway as well, they were saying was, you know, one of the reasons they'd come was, you know, yes, they'd looked at the ranking of the university, maybe we can touch upon that in a moment. Yes, they'd gone to look at the website, they'd gone to look at the programme. The programme was pivotal for them. They decided they wanted to study X. It mm-hmm. didn't really matter if, you know, if they really, really wanted to go to one university, but it didn't have that programme, then they couldn't go.
Yeah.
So there was that. But also, you know, what kind of support they would get. But really importantly, they were taught to students, alumni, or students who had studied either in that country or in that institution. Mm. Those student networks now, and those virtual networks, mm-hmm. I think, are starting to have equal, you know, importance of role as agents, as, you know, almost, it's almost as though that we're now, that front part of that funnel for students coming to institutions is being taken over by the students, quite rightly, really. It's less about people going out there and saying, this is what, maybe, you know, you need that profile out there, and people will go, oh, goodness me, I've not thought of that place. Now I'll go and see if I can connect into some alumni somewhere from that place. Then I'll move on to, you know, whether the institution, how I get recruited by them, do I go to them directly, they'll go to an agent and things like that, but you become more of a manager in that process as opposed to an active recruiter. And I thought that was interesting that you know, student and student opinion can really help drive where students are going and whether they accept or they don't accept, you know, certain institutions. But the one thing they did particularly mention was the support that they were going to be given. They totally understood and didn't expect that there was going to be a guaranteed type of employment mm-hmm. after it. But what they did expect, that there would be access to employers, mm-hmm. that there would be, you know, events set up so that they could meet employers, be it in this country or indeed back in their own country, you know, particularly interesting ones, slightly easier, obviously, to do it in country where you're delivering the programme, but again, we'll come back onto that in a moment. And where possible, that there would be an internship opportunity. Now, obviously, sometimes this is challenging when it comes to master's programmes, because often the appeal of a master's programme, certainly in the UK, is it's quite short. The fact that it's quite short means that you can't spend 6 months of it in an internship, otherwise it adds 6 months to your programme. So there are sort of more challenges, I think, from that point of view. But you've still got, within any master's programme, an opportunity for forms of, interaction with employers. It doesn't have to be that you do a six-month internship. So that aspect of it, and then actually asking the institutions, you know, so what evidence do you have for the graduate outcomes of your international students? I'm coming, and one of the students came from India, and he was saying, well, what support are you giving me to maintain the networks mm-hmm. that I've got in India? Because that's really important, he said, for me when I go back. So I might want to stay and do and work here for a short period of time, making, you know, some use of the graduate route, but I also do then want to go back. But I don't want to be out of my system in the country for 2 years and out of those connections. So, you know, how universities therefore firmly embed that as part of their strategies and plans, that it isn't just about doing that for home students, which universities have to do because they're measured on graduate outcomes for all the various league tables as well as everything else, but that we actually do it for all of our students, which we should, surely, anyway. You know, I thought that was, as is increasingly becoming a narrative, and I think ones that we need to take very seriously indeed.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That I saw that when I worked in Southeast Asia, and I see it to an extent here, that, you know, countries that have very strong internal network systems of patronage value international degrees, you know, on varying levels. But you step outside of your system and then you go back, and you're in essence almost disadvantaged by the fact that you've done the very thing that, you know, you've been told is what you need to do. And, you know, you've lost a few steps on the ladder as opposed to the person who remained within, you know, that system. And which is kind of obviously a very real problem for the individual themselves, and a hugely missed opportunity for the whole network wherever they've been. Because if you're trying to build these networks and the alumni and all this type of stuff, and if you're looking at new recruitment pathways, etc., you're then treating them potentially just as, yeah, come here, pay us money, and then bye bye, we don't want to see you again. And you think, well, yeah, there's a, not everybody's going to want to stay, not everybody's going to want to work. A lot of people will want to go home, wherever home is, or indeed go to a third country.
Absolutely.
You know, but it's, yeah, it's trying to better understand that. And as you say, if we don't, you know, and this is not a UK issue, this is a global issue, if we don't understand that, it'll be replaced by T&E. It'll be replaced by providers who are moving around and filling those gaps. Or it will be just replaced by the employment sector, who will say, actually, we don't need this anymore. Let's just have a graduate training program. We don't need that. We'll train you with what we need to do. And you know what? We'll pay you while we do it.
Yeah.
So.
And that's, I suppose, also one of the benefits that certainly England started to get with regard to degree apprenticeships.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, why wouldn't you do a degree apprenticeship if you get a degree at the end of it, and you it's not costing you anything to do your degree, and you get a great job at the end of it. I mean, I'd almost judge people who don't do one in that situation. Mm. I wonder whether, and at the conference, I had the pleasure of meeting again with Jessica Turner, who's the CEO of QS, you know, the World University Rankings, and amongst other things that they do. And indeed, you know, Jessica, it's going to be coming on the podcast soonish, we hope. But... you know, we've known, I mean, whatever you think of rankings, and again, that will be a discussion we can have with Jessica, and that would be great to hear. Obviously, there's lots of different types of rankings. QS is one of them. There are local ones as well that you might have. But I think it's safe to say that people do, students take them seriously, parents take them seriously. So therefore, you know, we all should be looking to them. And obviously for many years, it's very well established now, they've had their measures around academic reputation, employer reputation, you know, citations, student staff ratio, etc., etc. It's interesting now that this year they've got three new indicators. One is around sustainability.
Sure, yep.
One is around international research networks, you know, and the third is around employment outcomes. And funny enough, I did mention this at my own institution a couple of weeks ago. Now, at the moment, those three are only accounting for 5% of the total weighting of the Q. But I think also largely that's because they're new ones, and I think they need to test out that they can get the right, what kind of data that they need, that they can get the right data. But even if, you know, the only response that some institutions are going to have, because they want to ensure that they keep their place within the world rankings, is that it's measured in the world rankings, then if it's just starting there, it's only going to increase in importance. And if there's one thing that certainly the QS, but I know many other rankings as well, Times High, various others, are very good at, it's listening to the students. and science. And the reason they've introduced this is because it's been something that has been flagged, you know. Yep. We shouldn't just be measuring the international reputation when it comes to students, even, let's say, or student performance of universities by how many students they get in. And it isn't even just about how many students they retain or what those students achieve. It is also what happens to those students afterwards.
Yeah.
And we do measure that with home students in the UK. So why on earth shouldn't we be measuring it and be accountable for it for all students? I remember saying I did an online event for the Pi News probably a year and a half or more ago now, might even be 2 years ago. And we were talking about, you know, the shift in, and that was, it was in COVID a couple of years ago. I'm talking about the rise of sort of aggregators for agents and the fact that there were so many more agents around. And so that was it. And, you know, and one point I made was that, you know, often agents or anybody will perform depending on what you're linking into that performance criteria, you know. So agents do what they do because you pay them, you know, a percentage for the numbers of students who enroll and then begin at your institution, so that are able to enroll, that are good enough to enroll. So it isn't just about applications. I'm sure that if we said that we would pay agents 50% then and 50% when it came to the outcomes of the final outcome of the student, even the attainment of the student, what they actually achieve, or the graduate outcome, that would mm-hmm. make for an interesting proposition. It all went a bit quieter on the on the online session at that point. Bear in mind there were about 1,500 people on the call, you know, if we need those kind of incentives, if we need to do those kind of things, then we need to do them. But it is, I think, an interesting one, that it is something that the our rankings colleagues are also looking at. So I'm sure when Jessica comes on, it will be interesting to talk to her about any number of things, obviously, that QS do. But that, you know, the rise of aspects that that hadn't been part of those rankings before, I think will be an interesting one.
Yeah, and it ties back to stuff we've talked about and stuff we've written about, right? What's the purpose of university? What's the identity of a university? How does it engage with its community? How does it demonstrate that value and articulate it? And how do people perceive it? Because the choice pattern is different than it used to be. The costs are massively different. You know, the outcomes are, the expectations are different. You can't rely on old pathways. And yeah, that sort of, where do we place the emphasis? Where do we choose to acknowledge value, and how do we demonstrate it? I think it's you're absolutely right. It's going to be key. And I mean, and they all tie in, right? All of these issues that you talked about, they all tie into, you know, they're not any one of them by themselves the cause of the problem, but the problem is connected to, and the challenges are connected to, the way in which we are doing things and the way in which we understand the things that we are doing, right? So as you say, hopefully cooler heads will prevail, which in essence would be unprecedented, and we can pivot to a better solution. There you go. We got it in one sentence.
There is no way to follow that, sadly.
Yes. Well, so yeah, as you say, it ends on a sort of at least quasi hopeful note, right? There are, if not light at the end of the tunnel, there are signs along the way that we can follow.
And actually, that did come out in the final plenary. That was the point that was made. That, you know, that of course there are challenges. There are very difficult things that are happening across the world in lots of different sorts of ways. What we've got to try not to do is just focus almost solely on those things that are out with our control a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Deal with what you can deal with first. Do what you can first with those, and don't obsess about the things that, you know, you can't really influence. You know, just do what you can.
Yeah.
And then you might sleep at night, and then you might feel, you know, positive about the kind of things that you're doing. Because we do make a difference. And these students that were there, the people that were there, look at how we have come out of a truly awful time when it comes to a health pandemic. Look at the other health pandemics that we've come through in the hundreds of thousands of millions of years that the planet has been in being, you know, and that has been through people researching and, you know, finding out how to deal with these challenging situations and coming together and coming out the other side of it, you know. So there are positives, but let's not always focus on the negatives. Focus on what you can achieve,
what you can do.
And do that.
It's interesting. I was listening to a podcast last week called The Rest is History, and they were interviewing Tom Hanks, the American actor, about the space program, because he voices a space exhibit in London called Moonwalkers. And one of the questions they were asking him, because, I mean, he played an astronaut in the Apollo 13 movie, and he talked to the astronauts themselves. And, you know, they asked him, oh, well, you know, was there a sense that they were just panicking? Did they just think it was over? Like, how did they deal with this situation? And he said, no, they didn't really panic, because they realized that any time you go up in a plane, any time you go up in a spacecraft, there is the potential of abstract, you know, complete failure. And he said they just worked the problem. There's something to do. You do the thing in front of you, then you do the next thing in front of you, and then you do the thing after that. And you just as long as there's a problem that you can attack, that's what you do. Because obviously, if you focus on the fact that you're in a bean can, like in space, and your oxygen's running out, then you just give up. If people like up there can do it, then let's focus on the problem in front of us, and then the next one, right? So wonderful. But hey, it'll be great to talk to Jessica. About rankings, that's always
Jessica, and finally, you know, I did. There were various others who we met again. Big friends of the podcast, of course. Andrew Disbury was there, and Vicky Lewis. So it was great to see them both keen to come back on, and definitely, well, an old friend of you and I. I think he's a friend of our podcast as well, Tim Gore, Dr. Tim Gore.
Yes, OBE. So yes, indeed.
OBE indeed.
Yeah.
So Tim and all of his accolades hopefully will be joining us soon. And it was, as ever, it was wonderful to see him, and it was wonderful to see colleagues. And it would be great to get a few of them onto the podcast to hear what they've got to say.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, look forward to that. And in the meantime, still very jealous that you got to go. Sounds like it was a fantastic event, which is no surprise if you know UKI. I mean, it's no surprise, right? They are, so that's great. And look forward to more conversations down the line.
Yeah,